Food Talk with Mike Colomeco is brought to you by Cento at centofinefoods.com, King Arthur Flour at kingarthurflour.com, and Cola Vita at colavita.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey folks, welcome. Mike Colomeco here. We're listening. No, we're not listening. You're listening. I'm talking. Or something like that. It's Food Talk with Mike Colomeco here at Heritage Radio Network, live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Morgan Avenue, stop on the L train. And trivia here, when you step out of that stop, at least if you take the exit that I do, you exit on Bogart Street. Now, when I was a kid growing up, I was a huge Humphrey Bogart fan. I remember like just digging all those black and white Bogart and Cagney and all those great movies that the two of them made, especially Humphrey Bogart. And I bet you not many people in Williamsburg, but that street is actually named after Humphrey Bogart's great-great-great-great-grandfather, with maybe one or two greats plus or minus in there, a Dutch guy whose name was spelled kind of like Bogart's name was simplified. It was like Bogart or one of those O-E-R-T things. But yeah, that's actually Bogart Street in Williamsburg is a direct link to the great, the one, the only, the man, Humphrey Bogart, Casablanca, what a film. All right, so what are we going to talk about today? A couple of things. Here's the topics for today's shows. Well, actually, it's not topics, it's one topic. We're going to talk about seafood, something near and dear to my heart about seafood, about sustainability, about what to eat, what not to eat, resources for consumers to go to looking for information about seafood. And I've got two guests today, Curry Heffernan. Great New York chef, been here since 1979, which must mean he was about 16 years old when he got to the city, has been here ever since, has worked in some of the great restaurants with some of the great chefs in town. Last he was really active was probably 11 Madison Park a while back. Now he's consulting. We'll talk a bit about that. But he's really active in fisheries, in commercial fisheries. Like me, he bides his time between New York City and someplace sunny and beachy. In his case, it's out on the Long Island Sound, Sag Harbor, I believe, but he'll tell us. And we're going to talk about seafood with him for a good half an hour, again, about species sustainability, what to eat, what not to eat, the kind of fish we wish you were eating that you're not eating enough of, the kind of fish you might be eating that we'd like you to slow down on. And then for the second half an hour of the show, on the kind of the, not the other end of the conversation, but a guy who's kind of where the rubber meets the road, an old friend of mine, Lou Razzo, who runs Razzo and Sons, which is he's a fishmonger, does not have a retail store. He is a guy that supplies restaurants, really some of the best restaurants, well, not some of, yeah, he supplies most of the best restaurants in the city with their seafood, Bernadette, Danielle, you name it, third generation business, still in Manhattan, 9th Avenue, Lou's work hours are like 11 o'clock at night till 8 in the morning, 6 days a week, crazy guy, but we'll talk about what it's like to run a fish house in this crazy town of New York City. I'm going to give a shout-out to my boys up at Bettany, to Eamon and Bryce. I had a lunch there earlier in this week that was just great. Those guys are killing it. I'm going to be in there with cameras in a couple of weeks to do a PBS piece just on them because they're just really young, brilliant guys. Eamon in the front of the house, he's 28 years old, dude, 28, and he's a pro. He's great. He's got it. Parents were chefs, grew up down south, gets hospitality, runs an amazingly good dining room, great bar scene. They've got 3 stars at the end of the summer, which really helped them get over the edge from the New York Times, which is always, you know, for young restaurateurs, they could have, they both live in Brooklyn, they opened uptown, so it's that whole zip code bias thing. 57th Street's not the easiest street to run a business on, not the easiest clientele, but they did it. They hit the ball out of the park, they're great, kitchen's amazing, front of the house is amazing. Nice piece by Eric Asimov in the Times this week. I don't know if you read the Times on a weekly basis, but the Wednesday Times is always great to read. You know, you catch up on New York reviews. Florence Fabricant tells you who's opening, who's closing. Chef's on the Move. I always keep an eye on her piece. Asimov was writing about a kind of this odd grape, Savagnière, that comes from the Loire Valley. And it was just a great piece because he was talking about how some wines are – more demanding than others, right? Like sometimes you just want to watch a brain dead summer action movie or read, you know, a Tom Clancy versus a heavier lift. And wines are the same way. Sometimes you just want a friendly glass of fruit balmy, easy drinking wine. The truth is I almost never drink that stuff. I kind of prefer the demanding wines, but it was really nice for Asimov to sort of tease that out of it, how, you know, some wines just demand your attention. They're a little more austere. They've got that minerality, that backbone. They're not as revealing right off the bat when they're opened as others. They present a little more of a challenge for food pairings, but they reward so much. So it was great. If you didn't read that, it's great. And the Loire Valley is an area that I love to celebrate. Going to go to Contra tonight, a restaurant I haven't been to yet, one of the new additions to my neighborhood, Lower East Side of Manhattan. There's just so much talent going on down there. I visited the that market. What's that? Curry, what's that food court that just opened up on the west side? Pull that mic really close to you. I'll introduce you in a second. You know the one that has, it's on 11th Avenue?
Oh, yeah. It's
Gotham River West.
Yeah, it's where the guys from Grocery, right? From Market Table.
Well, it's Court Street.
Yeah.
Court Street's there. Ivan Ramen is there. A bunch of people there. Well, I went there for the first time because it's actually the opposite end of Manhattan. It's two trains. It's like literally like Caddy. It couldn't be further away from. I'm on the Lower East Side by the Williamsburg Bridge, and this place is two blocks from the Hudson River on the other side of town on the west side. But anyway, you know, I got to do this for a living. So I went and. It's just an amazing space. It's just going to take off. You can eat everything you want, from charcuterie to amazing sandwiches to some of the best ramen in the city, super beer, super good wines, just a whole bunch of different restaurants. And then there's a communal seating space where you just kind of go self-service, order your food, and you can eat anything from any of the vendors sitting in kind of these communal tables in the middle of the space. It's a great idea. There's a good little store in there, too, for equipment stuff. I was really impressed with that. So anyway, enough of that. Let's talk. Curry Heffernan's my guest. So grab that mic. Get as close to you as you can. It's funny. So the social media world, I'm an old guy, so I'm not the most adept at it. I really don't pretend to be, but it's here and it's unavoidable, and it's a space where everybody's in. So it's kind of you and I almost, I don't want to say caught up, but I would look at your posts and like realize that you stand up paddle.
Yes.
And I live in Cape May and I swim in the ocean. I'm a wannabe surfer. My kids are surfers. So we have this tie to the water, this tie to the culinary world. And then I would just see from your posts sort of what you're doing, what you're up and about. And then one of the things that really caught my eye was it last fall that you went to Monterey Bay?
No, so in the spring, in June.
Last spring.
Yeah, in June they have what they call Cooking for Solutions. So that's their big chef gala where they bring, you know, 20 or 30 chefs out and do these big walk-around tastings and all sorts of cool programming around it, you know, where the chefs – I led a tour of an abalone farm and did some abalone things. There's guys doing, you know, things with the local salmon runs, et cetera. The other thing that they do – which is really sort of mind-blowing for someone like me, and I'm sure you as well, is that they assemble this sort of brain trust of people over the 2 days to create these seminars. And the content is at a level that is just – I mean, it is the best and the brightest in the conservation space. And it's not just about seafood. It's also about, you know, GMOs and antibiotics and all the like. And – to just sort of be in those rooms as a fly on the wall, because I'm not at the level to participate. But you have guys like Paul Greenberg,
yeah.
And
wonder what wrote that great book a while back, Four Fish.
Four Fish, that's
such
right.
A captivating read,
unbelievable, yeah. And a great guy and a great writer and a real New Yorker, a real Brooklyn guy, who I subsequently, you know, became friends with. Who then, when he came to sign books out in Sag Harbor, dug clams with me and Brian Hallwell from Edible East End. So it was this great, amazing community, all brought about by our love of things aquatic. But this forum and these subjects and it's hard to sort of go to them and really concentrate on the upbeat side of it, because so much of it is doom and gloom. It's if you look at the charts and just sort of watch all the numbers and all the graphs, it's all not all mostly. Very, very disconcerting, because it's talking about you could almost go into any one of these meetings and look at, you know, fish populations in the 50s, 60s, whatever, and to current, and they'll be down
80%, 70%, 90%.
Exactly,
right.
Exactly. In almost every case. And so what we're left with managing is this small piece of biomass.
Right.
you know. And, you know, in some ways it's still a gift. It's still something that we can do something with. So, and there are still many success stories. We can't deny that things like Fluke on the East Coast has been well managed and is now in a strong population. There's other things affecting it because what's happening is the population size of the fish is actually moving north because...
Water temperature. Crazy.
Very simple. Right. So New Jersey, who has to have slightly different laws because of their southern anglers versus their northern anglers, and it's that much of a difference in a relatively small state like New Jersey, versus New York, which has access to a little bit colder water and therefore more and bigger fish. So it's very complex, but there's also success stories... and I say almost with a caveat, almost recently, like striped bass. I mean, we all remember probably what striped bass was like in the 70s. It was almost a myth. It was almost, my so-and-so caught him. There's this big, you know, tacky, falling apart mount of one in some, you know, dive bar that you go and look at. And I remember when, and, you know, and then you'd get them here and there, you know, sort of as an occasion. They were pretty much, you couldn't fish for them. And then they had the 36-inch limit, and that brought a lot of fish back, and then they became plentiful, and we had some great year classes. But I think people have gotten a little used to that, and now I'm actually personally very concerned for the future of striped bass as a large coastal population. There'll be pockets of great fishing. There'll be pockets of very large fish. What we're not seeing, unfortunately, is the good year classes and the abundance of those school fish of, you know, 28-inch, of even, you know, 20-inch fish in abundance that's going to say these fish are going to live to spawn and create
That's really one of the keys. And it, I mean, you mentioned stripers. It's one of the – it's I think every sport fisherman up and down the Northeast Coast, because that's really – from Maryland up to Gloucester, New Bedford's where they run.
Right.
And the sport fishermen love them. And I know the last couple of years it's just that they haven't been here. They haven't been close to the shore. We don't know quite why. We don't know if maybe what they were feeding on hasn't come in, but no one's catching them. And it's just been a scary drop the last couple of years.
Yeah.
And you're right, the limit we have in Jersey, because every state's a little bit different. You can't commercially fish them or sell them in New Jersey. You can
Thank
only
God.
Sport fish them. And the limit is 28-inch or above per person. And then one, I think, 30 or 32. So it's got to be a little bit bigger than the next one.
Right.
And that's it. So two per person max per day per boat, per people on the boat. But it's been a tough couple of years. And on the good years, I remember, because I open water swim, and you'll watch fish working the surface of the water. You'll watch birds working the surface. And if you look closely at that surface, you'll see that disruption across the top where stripers are underneath whatever the bait fish
is. They're driving the bait to the surface.
Driving the bait
birds.
To the surface. And literally the bait's jumping out of the water to avoid stripers and the
and
seagulls.
And getting attacked from above.
Yeah. But you always know. I always hate swimming through those pockets because it's like a scrum. It's like swim around them.
It's amazing. And when the population is healthy, they exhibit so many beautiful behaviors. Yeah. They come in shallow water. You even mentioned.
Way shallow.
You see them swimming behind people in the beach.
Yeah.
You know, in very, very shallow, clear water. So they're wonderful fish. You know, they've given a lot to this country. If you look at historically, they were very, very important, and we're just sort of missing the boat because there's a lot of big fish being caught. But that's because there are not a lot of small fish to catch. And so it'll be this great party, and then there'll really be nothing. And the one of the problems with striped bass, actually, for the most part, it's divided about 60-65% recreational, and the commercial catch is not that big. The problem is that they're in so many restaurants, and they're such a, you know, 3 years ago I would have said, what a great fish to eat. What a great local resource that's been managed well, that's something that represents history and is wonderful. Now I'm much more trepidatious about that. I'm not sure I would say eat striped bass. And the problem is that they were numerous, easy to catch, and they were in a lot of restaurants. What that encourages is a lot of poaching. Since people can, you know, go out and if you're a decent fisherman, you catch 2-3 bass, 20 pounds each, get $4 a pound.
It's gotten even worse. You and I talked about this. We'll change the subject in a minute. But tell that story. You know, since the government sequester, there's been a cutback on hiring and certainly a cutback on the enforcement of things like coastal fisheries management. So you'll have guys that you know who they
you
are.
You could go, and I might get in trouble for saying this, you could go into Sheepshead Bay, maybe not tomorrow,
right.
But 10 months out of the year, and see guys going out and catching plenty of striped bass way over the limit without any tags, and they are done by 8 o'clock because that's when they know that the guy from the DEC comes down and puts the key in the boat.
Done. They fish out. They get their couple thousand bucks worth of cash crop. They've been doing this forever. Consider it kind of their right because they're locals and their dad did it and their grandfather
did it.
And it's F the species. We don't really care.
Right.
Not my problem.
Right.
And the fisheries can't manage it because there's just not enough enforcement on that end of
Absolutely not. And if striped bass weren't on restaurant menus, they would have much less place to sell them.
Let's talk about some species. Let's do a checklist of species because we could go on and on stripers and we'll probably revisit this next time I have you on. One of the successes, and again, folks, if you're tuning in late to this, Mike Kalameko here, Heritage Radio Network, the show is Mike Kalameko's Food Talk. My guest is Curry Heffernan, who is a super accomplished chef, who's also a man that loves the water, a stand-up paddleboard guy. He loves living by the ocean as much as I do, which is to say, I don't think I could ever live anywhere else.
Absolutely not.
I got to be near the water, period.
Salt water, too.
Yeah, thank you. Salt water, too. All right, down by me, scallops were big, and that was another species that there was a success. The scallops were really being overfished in the 90s.
Right.
The scallop beds were being depleted. They were being closed. The numbers were dropping. And then NOAA got together with the fisheries and said, let's do some research. Why is this the problem? And what they found was those scallop boats that go out that drop that long chain, it's a dredge,
right,
because they get them off the bottom. They were catching immature scallops. Back to the striped bass story. They were catching scallops that were basically reproductive age,
right.
So they were depleting the juveniles,
sexually mature, right?
Sexually mature, so you can if you're eating the kids, you're not going to have another generation. By increasing that ring size gradually over the course of 3 or 4 years, to the point where they were getting bigger scallops that had already spawned, they basically allowed the scallop beds to reproduce, to rejuvenate, and since 1999, 2000, we've taken about 50 million pounds of scallops a year off the coast from Virginia to Gloucester, New Bedford, and it's stable, solid.
It's stable. It's one of the great fisheries that we can brag about. It's a great product. It's something that they're going to have on the West Coast as a sort of trophy. Here's an East Coast, they'll say diver scallop sometime, but a scallop, it's a day boat scallop.
Right.
It's of extremely high quality. It's not been treated with
nothing.
PHA.
Tripolyphosphates.
Right, to hold in the moisture and be terrible. These are beautiful products.
Yeah.
The price has actually come down significantly. So there is a wonderful success story. I mean,
what are some fish you don't want to see people eat? Let's talk about this. Species to avoid.
Well, I guess we could start locally.
Or just limit.
Right. Again, I'll go back to striped bass because I'm concerned there. And I think that I don't think the DEC or NOAA is going to get the biomass data quick enough to see the decline. It's just happening. And unfortunately, it's manageable and we can do something about it. You know, the bluefin. It's a very tough question. You know, I am a big recreational angler, and, you know, I fish for them. I don't catch many. They're really hard to catch to begin with, especially with the gear that we use, which is spinning or fly. So we don't have a lot of chance at it. We call it going bluefin looking, not bluefin catching. But they're such beautiful animals, and
We're talking about bluefin tuna, sorry.
They couldn't be more highly managed than the Northeast. So I wouldn't suggest that you go out and eat bluefin, but if I caught one and it was within the limits, I'd probably kill it and serve it to my friends.
Right.
So, you know, it's kind of a funny cusp there. Yellowfin populations are very strong. I would certainly suggest yellowfin, and when they come up...
And yellowfin, is that another name for albacore?
No.
It is.
You have bluefin.
I've seen the yellowfin aren't that big. How big do yellowfin get?
Well, okay. So you have bluefin, which you have Atlantic and Pacific populations. You even have a Southern Atlantic population, but Northern Atlantic bluefin is what we're talking about mostly here. You have yellowfin, which are not divided into such oceanic species, but there are larger specimens they call Allisons, and then there's a larger subspecies of yellowfin, which is considered a big eye. A big eye is different than yellowfin, but it's very, very close. And yellowfin populations, from everything I know, are very strong. And we get a great run of not huge fish, but typically, you know, 70 to 100-pound fish starting sometime in June. And they're in the canyons, which is the offshore 90 to 100 miles off the coast of New Jersey and New York. And they're following the Gulf Stream. They're following, you know, certain bait movements and water temperatures, etc. You have albacore tuna, which, you know, some years we have more than others. They're generally a little smaller, you know, 30 pounds, probably an average. But I've caught them as big as 60. And I think, you know, an albacore tuna caught, say, let's say September, October, who's been out in the canyons fattening up on those squid and herring and butterfish and all those wonderful baits, can be a real treat. And it's not something that East Coast, people who love fish know so much about. It's much more popular in the West Coast because they have a much stronger population of albacore. It's also a great recreational species that moves up as far as San Francisco and even further north in some years. So albacore, yellowfin, big eye. We had a run of big eye this year that was insane. They were 170, 190, 200-pound big eye tuna that these guys were pulling over. And I've cooked an awful lot of tuna in my day, as I'm sure you have. And I got some of these fish that were, you know, caught on commercial gear. So they're brought in on heavy tackle very quickly. No fight.
Right.
No
stress, no strain.
No stress, no lactic acid. And they were as good for cooking. I say for cooking. As certainly better than bluefin. I don't think bluefin is that good to cook. I think it's obviously better raw. Great yellowfin. But this big eye was phenomenal. It was in another class. It was firm enough to slice and hold up, but the mouthfeel, the tenderness, the fat in this animal was just it was a celebration. It was something really, really special. And as I said, I've seen a lot of fish come over the rails, and this was something very special. So those are species I would certainly – I think it's time for everyone – you know, skate, I know it's been done to death, but there's nothing wrong with – keeping that train going.
I love skate. I skate all the time. It's funny because sport fishermen hate them because it's hard to get them off the hook. You're probably fishing for stripers and you ended up getting skate.
That's right. Or fluke generally on the bottom.
Or fluke because you're on the bottom. That's right. With squid or something or clam and this damn But, you know, you talk about great cheap protein. When I used to live in the West Village, I used to shop at the Lobster Place. Great retail store.
Right.
He's got a wholesale operation, so you're pretty much getting wholesale quality, good wholesale quality fish. You know, $7, $8 a pound completely clean protein fish.
Oh, yeah.
You know, a little milk, a little flour, put it in the pan, meniere, brown butter, capers. I mean, well, you could do it a million ways, but so good, so delicious. And as a guy that open water swims, I'll tell you, when it's clear, when there's not a lot of when the sediment's not stirred up, the turbidity's right, and I can see the bottom in Cape May, covered with skate. Yeah. Covered. They're on top of each other.
Wow.
Yeah, they're huge. So that's a good one. Swordfish, where are we with sword these days?
That's a good question. The East Coast population is okay, but they're not as big as they used to be, unfortunately, still. But it is considered by the people who I respect, which is Monterey Bay and EDF, who both have great websites, by the way.
We should get to that. So after this, keep going.
Right. It's considered a well-managed population, especially the West Coast. And what's amazing is I'll go into the various fish markets, and you know I live on top of a Whole Foods, literally, on 7th Avenue and 24th Street. And swordfish is one of the things that is almost always in the best shape at Whole Foods. So, you know, I was of the mind even 7 or 8 years ago to say no. Now I'm of the mind to say yes. And again, in moderation. Obviously, you know, avoid the bloodline because that's where any heavy metals or mercury might
reside. And you are going to find mercury in these fish that are sort of alpha predators, the ones that live the longest, get the biggest, eat the fish that eat the fish that eat the fish, like tuna. Even striper with PCBs, you have to be careful because they'll spawn near the rivers where that stuff's coming in. So the only reason I watch swordfish is for mercury.
Yeah, avoid the bloodline. Right. And with striped bass, if you're concerned about it, especially with the bigger specimens, avoid the skin.
Yeah, right.
The skin and that fatty, that gray matter that resides by it. Bluefish.
I think
bluefish is an extraordinary. Yeah. And again, it all starts with the consumer. If people are demanding better quality fish, then they're going to take better care of the fish, and they're going to make sure that the bluefish is handled in a way that makes it special. Smaller animals generally are preferred because they're eating smaller baits.
Yeah, we call them snapper blues down by me. So this
or even a cocktail size. It could be up to 4 or 5 pounds.
Such great fish, and it's funny because it's that kind of brownish, reddish. I love it, so I'm not going to say it's not a trap, but I think for the consumers, it's like weird, and people say it's fishy. And then when you cook it, it almost turns like this beautiful white, gray, beautiful color. From heat, and it's such – I mean, if you eat Rouget, if you eat fish that tastes like something, it's one of the best-tasting fish, I think, out there.
If you ideally catch it yourself into a nice slurry, you can make a tartare. You can make a crudo that is like hamachi. It's like northeastern hamachi. It is really underappreciated, mostly because it's been badly handled and badly cooked. It's almost like the cauliflower of fish, you know?
Thank you. And I think mackerel falls in that same category. Atlantic mackerel. People steer away from it. And then you talk to guys that, you know, the really good sushi guys, and they're like, dude, that's some of my favorite fish to work with.
Well, my favorite would be Spanish mackerel. Spanish mackerel, again, well handled and a big specimen, could be really, really extraordinary. I caught one almost 9 pounds in Florida. I couldn't believe it. It was one of the best things I've ever eaten in my life. We generally don't get them that big up here. We get a run of them. They're smaller, but, you know, on Martha's Vineyard, a lot of fishermen, that is their favorite fish to eat, the Spanish mackerel. And it's sort of rare.
And the Asians love it, too. The Japanese love it. The Koreans love it.
Because it's good. It's so good raw. It's got good fat content. And it's firmer than Atlantic mackerel. So you're going to get – it's a little bit more forgiving to work with. Something else, porgy. Considered
porgy. And what croakers.
Also known as scup.
Right, scup, yep.
Is a way underappreciated species. I think if people got them, again, they weren't worth a lot. They were often caught small. They're considered bony, but it's really not so much their skeletal structure as their size.
Correct. The fillet, the yield. I mean,
the yield on a small porgy is going to be
nothing.
Pitiful. But cook it whole. Eat it off the bone. And this is something else that's very important for people to consider, is let's sort of reanalyze again portion size. Do you really need 10 ounces of clean protein to call it dinner?
Right.
I don't think so. I think that's a bit ridiculous. And the expectation in restaurants, to some extent, is still to deliver that, and that just sort of sets
it is. And we'll have Lou on here next in a few minutes. I'll bring Lou in because, you know that chefs are saying to him, I need an 8 to 10-ounce portion of clean protein. That's what I'm looking for. So if I'm ordering black bass, toe tog, whatever, I want it so that I'm getting those portion sizes, whether it's on one side or two person, whatever. That's how I do my math.
Right. Quite literally. And unfortunately, people don't think they've had dinner unless they've in a restaurant. Yet at home, they'd be perfectly comfortable eating a lot less because they paid for it. Maybe they understand what the price is. But that's certainly going to help everything in the whole food chain, is if we sort of reanalyze the amount of clean protein that we need to eat. And that's going to make room for what? More amazing vegetables. What's wrong with that?
That's another discussion, but it's absolutely the truth. Talking about biomass depletion and maybe the poster child, and it was one of the four fish in Greenberg's great book. If you haven't read that book, folks, Four Fish is just a great read. It outlines four historical fish in America that are still around today. Each of them tells a story about biomass depletion. And one of them is, of course, North Atlantic cod.
Yeah.
So this was the fish that America's fisheries was based on. The Portuguese came here. They loved cod. The Portuguese settled basically New Bedford and Gloucester.
The Scandinavians, too.
The biomass of cod, no one knows how far down it is. Estimates accurate between 80 and 90% gone from what it used to be. But with the remaining 10 or 20%, we don't know what the numbers are exactly, it's being managed. Talk a bit about cod. How do you feel about that as a fisheries to eat now? Because it is being managed, even though it's been overfished to the extent that it was.
It's not something I would suggest you go out and eat tomorrow. North Atlantic cod.
Yeah.
Or I would say sort of New England or Canadian cod. There is some Icelandic cod, you know, that's certainly available and it's certainly wonderful. And that kind of goes to the whole transparency issue, which I think is something that's very hard for consumers to understand because people, you know, the fish, they're not doing DNA tests on it. And they are not, you know, often, unless it's farm raised, they're not tagged. So you don't necessarily know if someone represents this. I was in a fish market yesterday that'll remain nameless, and they had wild striped bass, which kills me because now what they're taking.
This big?
No, they were huge.
Oh, they were huge. Okay.
What they're taking is the fish that are getting ready to spawn. So they were likely females because they're that big. They were likely pregnant and full of eggs. And they're coming from places like North Carolina and Virginia that still have open fisheries for them. And it was being sold as New York wild fish when New York has been closed since December the 15th. I mean, it's a very old one. I don't think that was a New York fish.
What was the Times story a while back where they were doing sushi restaurants? Was it salmon or farm-raised versus wild? The Times did an expose a while back. I forget what the species was. I think it might have been salmon, where mislabeling was just so rampant. It was crazy. It was 75% of it was being sold as wild and it was farm-raised because just to switch gears, if you're not eating Alaskan salmon, if you're not eating that, and that run will start in April or May,
right,
and run through the summer, depending on the species.
Correct.
Start with Copper River, move into sockeye, move into pink, blah, 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 blah. Then they'll freeze them, and they'll freeze them all season long, and you can buy them as frozen
correct
fillets all
right
year long. But unless you're eating Alaskan salmon, you're eating farm-raised salmon, period.
99% of the time. I very much doubt you're getting a wild Atlantic salmon
right
because there are so few.
There's very few of them. And in Europe, it's the same thing. There was a fisheries there. Greenberg outlines that in his book as well. They used to spawn in Connecticut, run up through the rivers up into Connecticut, Massachusetts, and we dammed the rivers and the species collapsed.
You're going to love this one. There was a picture of a guy on a paddleboard in Co-op City.
Fishing?
Who caught an Atlantic salmon?
No.
On a paddleboard outside Co-op City.
That's
so there
too
were
cool.
There are a few.
There are a few, but they got to be lonely. Very, they got to be lonely. My last thing, shark. I see shark on the menu. I know down by me, I see people, the Mako's in the market. I mean, with shark species is so depleted. We have so overfished shark. Shark fin is like a whole criminal thing we wouldn't even talk about. But what's your feeling about people eating shark?
You know, there's Mako and there's Thresher and Poor Beagle that you can eat because they have
and then dogfish or whatever you want to call those because they're plentiful is crazy.
Well, dogfish I would suggest eating. I would not suggest eating Mako because it encourages people killing sharks and finning. And I think it's just a little too they're if you catch one and want to kill it, great. I would encourage you to release it, but I think that unfortunately the shark population is too fragile and it's not in terrible health, but it's not something I'd recommend people going out to eat. You know, there's so many other things to eat that are great.
I mean, again, back as you said, croakers, porgies,
sea robin.
You know what? See, I never saw it down in Cape May until 3 or 4 years ago, and then I started seeing it in the Chelsea market. Man, oh man! And again, talk about another fish. So you're eating this little—it's two fillets on a bone. You're eating the tail, basically, kind of like a little mini monkfish tail.
Well, it's like an ice cream cone if they get big enough.
Tiny little things, but so you just roll them in flour, put them in a sauté pan. They cook in about 8-10 minutes. You start to walk off the bone when they're done. So they're easy to such delicious fish. And again, I think they were selling them for like $6 a pound.
They should because they're extraordinarily plentiful.
Right.
There's something called blowfish that come and go in spring and fall and are amazing.
Blowfish tails are amazing.
Blowfish tails are absolutely amazing, and it's a bit of a local specialty. But if you see them, grab them.
Yeah.
Scallops for bay scallops. We didn't have a great bay scallop year, so unfortunately there have not been a lot of pecanic bay scallops around. But you never know. Maybe next year is going to be better. You know that it goes to eelgrass restoration and kind of a longer story. But there's still a lot of good stuff out there and a lot of great opportunity for people who want to sort of be a little more adventurous. I think it forces you to go a little deeper as a cook, and I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, there has to be an onus on chefs at some point because Americans just love their tuna, love their salmon, love their shrimp. Those are the three big fish that drive 90%
of
sales.
And shrimp are generally challenging, shall we say, in terms of sustainability. The methods to catch them if you're lucky, they're going to use an autotrawl that has turtle and other mammal excluding devices. But best case scenario, they're talking about 10% of yield on a trawl. So that means 90% of other juvenile species bycatch. It just goes right over the side.
We're going to get you back because this is something. We're going to get you back, and we'll have four topics next time. You and I will pull down. And when we talk about Long Island, what you do out there, because this is a New York-based radio station. Long Island's a really interesting place. I can talk about Cape May forever, but talk about what you see going on out there from the salt harvesting to everything else, because it's a great story. And some of the stories you've gotten involved with fishing out
there. Well, my little third of an acre and my fishing is just central to who I am, and I bring that to places like Dillon Prime that I'm consulting at right now. And hopefully, this book that I'm working on is going to highlight that as well.
Curry Heffernan, great to have you. You'll be back on in a couple of months because we could go on forever. Great to catch up. Folks, you're listening to Mike Colomeco's Food Talk on Heritage Radio Network. We're going to take a quick break for a couple of minutes and come back with Lou Razzo, who's going to tell us what it's like to deliver the stuff to restaurants at 4 in the morning.
And he delivers to us. He's a great guy.
Hey, man, thank you.
Life takes its toll in this city. It'll knock you down, hit you straight on your knees. dollar showed there ain't no pretty pennies. Invested all I had, every cent in both you and me. Time is tavern with a pretty lady. We own that jukebox paid for with our skin. Sometimes we're great, sometimes it got right shitty. And even when the drink's done, drank a coffee.
Hey folks, Mike Colomeco here. Any good chef will be honest with you and tell you about 80% of good results from cooking is good shopping. You have to start with great ingredients. So when I'm looking to make a canned tomato sauce at home, I use Cento San Marzano tomatoes, which I've loved, used them for years. When I had my restaurant, that's what I bought. When I was a chef at restaurants and I could supervise the purchasing, that's what I ordered. They're great. I actually had a chance a few years back to go visit the area where they're from because I'm always curious with ingredients. What is the provenance? So we flew in the middle of August to this little region just in the shadows of Mount Vesuvius where there's great volcanic soil. And what I found out was these tomatoes come from lots of small family farms, little quarter and half acre plots where that's what they do. They raise tomatoes and sell it to the Cento factory that packs this tomato in the peak of the season in the middle of the summer. Cento nourishes the San Marzano tomatoes from start to finish with a 100% certified traceability program. Cento's San Marzano certification is the only one of its kind, assuring the consumer of authentic San Marzano tomatoes. So if you're looking for great canned tomatoes for great tomato sauce, look no further than Cento brand San Marzano.
King Arthur Flour, established in 1790, is America's oldest flour company. They're an employee-owned company whose passion is sharing the joy of baking and inspiring bakers worldwide. When King Arthur was founded in 1790, George Washington was the newly elected president of the United States. The company was sold by the Sands family to King Arthur Flour employees in 1996. They are now an ESOP company, 100% employee-owned, with a 100% commitment to quality. Visit them at kingarthurflour.com.
Mike Colomeco here. When I started my PBS show, one of the deals with producing a PBS show is you're always looking for underwriters. And I thought, let me start first by going after people whose products I actually use in my kitchen. I had a restaurant for years. I used Colavita olive oil. I did some research and found out that in the extra virgin category, it was the only Italian olive oil that was actually 100% Italian origin. There's a lot of stuff going on in that business that we don't really want to talk about. But a lot of the big brands call themselves Italian, have Italian flags on the labels, and their blends from tank farms from all over the planet. Pretty much based on price. Colavita is the exception. Really love the oil. Been using it in my house. Reused it in my restaurant. Well, Colavita is doing something neat. They're doing a contest. If you go to italycontest.com or colavita.com, where there's a link, but again, Italy Contest is the more direct way to do it. They're doing a contest on substituting butter for olive oil in baking goods. The winning recipe gets a free trip to Italy, courtesy of Colavita. So if you're thinking about cooking with olive oil and you're a baker, throw them your recipe at italycontest.com or visit colavita.com and click the link there. You may win a trip to Italy.
If the last four numbers, then it
Hey, folks, welcome back. Mike Kalameko here. Mike Kalameko's Food Talk Heritage Radio Network is what you're listening to live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. That's right, the epicenter of hipster paradise. My next guest, Curry Heffernan, was great. We've got to get him back because he and I rambled. I had a bunch of subjects we talked about, and we stayed on point, but we could have borne down a little deeper on some of these. We'll do that next time. He'll be back. He's a great guy, great chef, great fisheries guy. My guest right now, Lou Razzo, third generation or fourth, Lou?
Fourth generation.
Get close to that mic. Put that mic right in front of you. I know it looks weird, but it sounds better.
We started in 1899. My great-grandfather started the business.
And it was crazy because as the story went, that you told me he was a grave digger or something, and then his wife talked him into it. How did this work? Because it was some kind of back alley.
My great grandfather was a grave digger,
Italian immigrant. So people came here and did anything, whatever they could to make a living.
And his wife, my great grandmother, worked as a fillet woman for an Irish company. You know, back then the fish business was all Irish, and now it's not anymore. And my great grandmother made five times as much money as my grandfather digging ditches, digging graves. So they decided that they would try to go into the fish business. So it took them literally 5 days to find the Fulton Fish Market. And once they got there, nobody would sell them anything because you had to get approved by, you know, the powers to be back then in the Fulton Fish Market. So my great-grandmother got her boss to, you know, put in a good word. They bought their first box of fish, and they made more money from that box of fish than they did working all week.
Wow. 18, what was the year?
1899.
So you're one of the guys. You're still in Manhattan. Your store's still on the building. Thank God you own it.
Yes.
The building's still on 9th Avenue in the 20s.
Between 19th and 20th Street. And, you know, I toyed with the idea of moving up to Hunts Point like all the other fish companies did.
Right.
And what really made me unique was to be able to have a place in Manhattan, be able to get to places like Le Bernardin and John George at the drop of a dime. And that's flourished my business, and it's a beautiful thing for me.
Well, you know, I'll see you out and about at restaurants because, first of all, you're a really social guy. You're tons of fun. We're both members of New York Athletic Club, as is Mark Sarazan Jr. So there's a whole cadre of us that are in this business that have...
Good people
that hang out. And of course, you look at Lou out in a restaurant and you think, wow, what a fun business it must be. Look at this guy, and he's out there, and he's supporting his customers by eating at the restaurants, and this must be good. Talk a little bit about, you know, the Wizard of Oz. We're going to pull back that green curtain.
Well,
I mean, when does your day start and technically end?
Well, I'm, you know, Monday mornings, I'm there at midnight. I'm there at 12:30 in the morning. Then Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, I come in about 3 o'clock.
Three in the morning.
You know, we make well over 200 deliveries a day, so it's all about getting the fish into the fish store, getting all the fish weighed up, getting all the fish filleted, pin bone, skinned, all the work you have to do for each individual customer because each chef wants their fish a different way, and load the trucks and get them out. And you know, you want to try to get to the stops, you know, before noon.
So. And remember, folks, if you've never been in the restaurant business, most good chefs are calling in their fish orders every night after service based on what's sold.
That's right.
Maybe we had a run on scallops today, but we didn't sell a lot of striper, but I need tuna. So it's this 24-hour clock, basically, of, I don't know, it's like the chicken or the egg. So the chefs leave messages on your answering machine, or I'm sure they're talking to live bodies
of the time. I have guys answering the phone 24 hours a day.
So the chefs are calling in their orders at 12, 1, 2 in the morning based on what they need. You're coming in at 2:30, 3 o'clock.
I have guys, we stagger, so we're open all day. I have guys there all day.
It's a 24-hour operation.
Right. So our business, though, is redundant because a lot of the customers are ordering the same things every day. Like Danielle's order, you know, Thursday going into Friday, it's going to be big. But every day, Danielle's order is about the same thing. Same with Le Cirque, you know, same with the No Booze. You can almost predict what restaurants are going to order, you know, because their history. So we have a pretty good idea. You know, I'm buying the fish 2-3 days in advance. So if I bring in a 4,000-pound container of tuna fish, I'm buying it on Monday and getting it probably, you know, Tuesday night, Wednesday morning. So we have a pretty good idea of how much of each fish we're going to sell, you know, daily.
And you've got guys cutting. I mean, half your business must be making ice.
Yeah, well, it's a hard business. I have 7 guys filleting fish all day long, you know, from 1 o'clock in the morning to 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and all they're doing is filleting fish and preparing it for the customers.
Name some of the customers. You've already named them, but when you look at the great restaurants in New York, you're selling Danielle Boulud, one of the great
yeah,
chefs.
And really
John George. Eric Repair, I mean, Bernadette really reinvented seafood cookery. Yeah, really invented how fish is handled.
It's an honor for me to sell all three of those places you mentioned, and it's more fun for me to go there and eat, you know, in the restaurants. And I make it a habit to try to eat in every restaurant I sell.
Michael White at Marea, one of the great modern seafood houses.
I just ate in his new restaurant. In fact, I sat next to Mayor Bloomberg, which was quite a thrill.
Former Mayor Bloomberg. Three-term mayor.
But his restaurant on the Upper East Side, Marini, is fantastic, and I recommend it to anybody.
Yeah, pretty much all of Michael's establishments still are solid. I'm always worried about the day that
he's also a great guy.
Yeah,
he's
great.
He's a loyal customer. You know, he's a demanding customer, but he's a guy that I'm happy to call my friend.
On the supply side, I know that I've been in your store. I know the phone rings, and you'll get a captain coming in, cruising into Montauk, saying, hey, this is what I have. Talk about that. Talk about your relationship with the fishermen on the other end of the spectrum.
I have great relations. Commercial fishermen can be a little bit wacky at times.
Not can be. I live in Cape May, right? So, yeah, so we got a lot of captains. We got a lot of guys that run boats. It's a big fisheries.
And Cape May is flourishing now. I'm starting to bring in a lot of the oysters to Cape May.
Yes, Cape May salts.
Yeah, now they've been sold fantastic. Through.
Shout out to them. This is a triploid oyster that was kind of actually engineered in China to survive. They don't reproduce, and they have been able to survive the sort of plagues that have killed the oyster beds in America. They're great. They're raised on an estuary basin that's tidal, so they're out of the water and in the water during the day, which is perfect. Great tasting oyster. So if you've never had Cape May salts, big shout out. But anyway, I interrupted you.
You're right, though. Now customers are asking them by name, asking for those oysters by name.
Good.
And it's a product I'm happy to sell. But what was your question?
You were talking about I was saying your relationship with captains.
Oh, you know, so these commercial fishermen.
Right.
You know, it's funny if it's raining even a little, you have to beg them to go out and fish because some of these guys are a little lazy. But they, you know, especially the Long Island guys, especially during striped bass season where it ended December 15th, they would catch striped bass and drive it right to my fish door. So I would get the fish, you know, 3 hours out of the water. So they're still trying to breathe. And that for me is a beautiful thing to get that fresh fish from my fish door to the restaurant, you know, a matter of 5 hours out of the water is, you know, that's when I know I'm doing my job. And a lot of the local fish, fluke, flounder, striped bass, monkfish, even tilefish from New Jersey now, starting to sell tilefish from New Jersey. Those are the fish. I mean, I fly fishing from all over the world, but when you deal with the local fishermen, you know you're getting that fish, you know, 5-6 hours out of the water. And to move that type of fish, and you know you're making a chef happy on the other end, is why.
And a customer happy on the other end.
And a customer, too, yeah. So, you know, dealing with the local fishermen is a beautiful thing.
They're great guys. It's funny. I think that this is something I've tried to shed a light on this over the years and tried to get them on TV. There's an independent streak to commercial fishermen.
Oh, absolutely.
And they're not sometimes the most socially engineered people. But when you think about what they've chosen to do, they're the farmers of the sea.
They're all pretty good drinkers, though.
Oh. they live out on the water, and they're living on these boats where the quarters are pretty cramped. They're in the wheelhouse most of the day.
And it's rough.
You know, on a nice day in the summer, it looks like it must be paradise. Yeah. Well, the other 8-9 months of the year, to be out on the Atlantic now when it's, you know, 15-foot seas.
Freezing.
And the ocean temp is 38 degrees, and there's wind and hail and ice and snow. It's brutal.
And also, they're dealing with a lot of government regulations and government restrictions as far as the weight they can take out of the water, and I think it's made their jobs and their businesses a lot harder.
Oh, way has.
Yeah,
but on the other hand, I mean, if we don't do species management,
it's
sort of the tug of war. Is if we left it, our ability to catch fish has far exceeded fish's ability to reproduce.
Oh, absolutely, and the whole philosophy of sustainability is what you take out of the water now doesn't affect future generations. And I think America is heading in the right direction, but
We have the best managed fisheries on the planet.
But
out 200 miles.
Outside of our country
is
where you see a lot of problems. You see a lot of pirating. You see a lot of total disregard for the species of the fish, like tuna fish.
Yeah.
Especially tuna fish.
Especially tuna fish.
So, you know, as a guy who purchases a lot of fish, I really try to make sure that I'm doing the right thing and buying from the right people and obviously going by the guidelines.
What are some of the species that you're selling, if there are any, that are kind of neat new, maybe growing in popularity. Curry and I talked about, you know, porgies and croakers and Spanish mackerel. And well, I mean, I'd love to see another thing. I'd love to see is the consumers. You know, because it's going to be the chefs are going to have to market it, but the consumers are going to have to buy it. If the consumer's getting away from just swordfish, salmon, tuna, I mean, those are the big fillets everybody wants to sell. They're easy to portion. They look good on a plate. But what are some of the stuff that you're selling that you see kind of slowly growing in popularity?
Well, what you said is absolutely right. If like the restaurant Momofuku, which
David Chang, he's
you know,
at this
and
point,
he's the guy. For my in my opinion, he started to buy the porgies, so he featured porgies on the menu, and from there, I think it kind of exploded. So you're starting to see porgies on a lot of menus. I mean, and the fish is a beautiful fish. If you get a 2-pound porgie, and I'm getting them, you know, 4 or 5 hours out of the water, out of Long Island, and to eat them whole, I mean, I highly recommend anybody go to Momofuku and have the porgies over there. They're fantastic. So you know. Also, to your point, I think that people, the misconception is fish is hard to prepare at home. So they're more apt to go out to a restaurant and order that fish rather than buy it in a store and bring it home and cook it, which is good for me because people are eating fish in restaurants, you know, and cooking them less at home. But it is a misconception that fish is hard to work with, and it really is not.
You know, I don't do it anymore. I just stopped this year for a couple of reasons. But I used to do cooking classes for the 92nd Street Y once a month for most of the year. And they would sell out in a heartbeat because we could only take about 30 people to fit them in the space where I did them. And the one class that would sell out literally in a half an hour once it was posted was seafood cookery. Because people were really curious about this.
It's healthy.
Well, I mean, everyone knows we should be eating a couple of days a week a portion of fish and, and less meat. But between the idea of their apartment, A, smelling like fish, which is something I hear that always cracks me up, like, that so if your apartment smells like steak, because none of us have good hood systems. Even, I mean, I've got a really nice apartment with a windowed kitchen, and I got a hood above it. All that hood does is blow that smoke back in my face.
Bear in mind that the smell of fish is something that I've grown up with very intimately.
Dude, in my house, I mean, if you roast a chicken, your house smells, I mean, so what's wrong with the house smells like fish for the next couple of hours?
It has gotten a bad rap along the way, and, you know, there's... The smell of fresh seafood is a beautiful thing.
It's a great thing.
It's a beautiful thing. It smells like the ocean.
And fish cooks so quickly. I mean, fish is one of those proteins, unlike if you're, you know, you could, you put it in a pan, you flip it over, you get some good color on it.
Right?
It really takes, very rarely does it take more than 3 or 4 minutes.
And it really depends on the freshness of the fish. Yeah. I mean, you have to be concerned. You have to know what you're doing.
Where are you sourcing your scallops from? I'm curious because that's an East Coast. That's a Northeast Coast fisheries.
I'm getting them out of New Bedford.
Right, New Bedford's big.
Right now they found a pocket, so you've seen a lot of scallops out of New Bedford.
Big, I mean, big scallops.
Big scallops, under 10 scallops, and
huge.
And they're beautiful. I mean, a lot of restaurants demand them, so I really have to hunt them down. Right now, out of New Bedford, I'm getting a lot of scallops. But I think New Jersey and Barnegat Light did a pretty good job this year producing scallops, as you're aware, I'm sure.
Yeah, and we have Kate May, because we have two guys down there, Danny Cohen and Keith Lauderman.
And they do a great job.
Huge. They own about 80% of the permits, because that's the scallop
business.
And a lot
of boats. They own a lot of
boats. They've got a lot of permits, and we've just seen really big, fresh, dry scallops coming in.
Fascinating.
It's a great fisheries, because we were talking earlier about, you know, back in the old days, and I guess still there's, you know, the underbelly of this business where you'd have less scrupulous vendors who were tripolyphosphate. Remember that stuff?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, you'd be surprised. A lot of scallops are still dipped. They're just not dipped as long. They're dipped overnight or for a few hours. It makes the scallop a little bigger. It makes them...
Pick up water.
They pick up water, but when you cook it, it all comes out.
Yeah. But the scallops you're selling aren't dipped.
No, I try very hard. I will not buy those scallops.
My
customers won't allow me to buy that. I mean, so God forbid if I ever send those scallops to carry half of them.
Because you can see it right away as soon as you put it in the pan. They'll just weep.
As soon as you put it right in the pan, the way it colors and the way it...
Right, so folks, what this means is that a scallop boat goes out, and depending on... Usually the boats go out for a week to 10 days till they catch what they need to catch to make it commercially viable. There's a captain, there's a crew of 8 or 9 gentlemen on board that boat, and the shifts they work are 8 on, 8 off. They're constantly fishing.
Constantly
fishing.
Dragging.
They drag, they dredge, they pull up out of that dredge scallops in shells, which are really big, and the guys that work on the boat do nothing all day long but shuck scallops.
And it's a fascinating process. I mean, it really is. It's unbelievable.
Shells go overboard. If you ever want to sport fish, you follow a scallop boat, because there's a lot of fish following scallop boats.
A lot of birds,
a lot of big fish, because it's like they're being hand fed all the trim. And then those scallops, once they're pried out of the shell, they're washed twice in salt water, because every boat has a pump, and they pump water into the sea.
That's right.
They're washed twice in salt water to free them of any debris, of sand, of anything that's on them. Then when they're... After that second wash, they're put in these kind of canvas bags that will be up to 50 pounds. It's a 50-pound bag sealed with a little lead cinch. They go down in the hold and they're iced.
And that's how I get them.
That's how they get to the dock, and that's how they get into distribution. Now, what we're talking about with the unscrupulous characters is they will get those bags of scallops, open them up, soak them for 2 hours to 8 hours, 10 hours,
to even
in a mixture
night.
Of water, tripolyphosphate.
Dumping that whole bag in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that, and what that does, it just blows up the scallop with fluids,
water,
and it becomes a less quality product.
Yeah.
But what I encourage now, I don't know, the Nantucket Bay Scallop season is open right now, and those are my favorites.
Candy,
scallops.
Like candy.
You know,
amazing scallop.
Every single night I have them flown in FedEx from the island, and they are just amazing. They might be my favorite thing in the water.
One of them. Now, I was with my son the other day. My son now works in New York City for a good buddy of mine. I got him an apartment in Astoria and a job.
How old is he?
He's too old. 24. He's whatever.
24.
He's a boy.
His own apartment in Manhattan.
Astoria. Yeah, God bless him. 24. But he's tired. He's working. He's doing elevator repairs. Anyway, shout out to Sean. He, great kid. He's working his butt off. So I take him out to dinner. He's exhausted. By 9:30, 10 o'clock at night, he's nodding out because he's literally up at 5 o'clock and at work at 6:30 on his feet all day. But so for a treat, you know, it's kind of nice to have him around. I took him to the 21 Club a couple of weeks ago. Interesting old iconic New York restaurant. What do you do at 21? You eat like classic stuff. So some oysters to start with, the crab cake. And I said, let's split a Dover sole. Talk about Dover sole. Do you carry them?
I sell a lot of them. I sell Dover sole to Las Vegas every night.
It is such an interesting fish. So this is a flat fish that very much looks like a fluke or a flounder or any of the East Coast flat fish we're used to.
It's got a much more delicate taste.
And firm protein. And even Sean, who grew up in my house, we eat a lot of fish, and it's really fresh from Cape May. It's super dense, super almost like steak-like. Why do you? What is it about that fish?
You know, the Dover sole I fly in from Holland. They catch them right there and ship it to me. So I'm getting that fish less than a day out of the water. The fish is a thick, very white, firm piece of meat. And they cook up just differently than a fluke or a flounder. And when you eat them, it's like butter, like melts in your mouth.
It's incredible.
It's
just
incredible.
An incredible piece of egg. To see a kid who's basically been eating my local, you know, he knows flatfish. And he's like, dude, you're totally right. There's something about the protein, the firmness, there's this just great flavor.
And right now, Dover sole there's a lot of Dover sole around. The price is way down. I encourage you, right now is the time to buy Dover sole. You'll see it more in the restaurants now because the price has dropped a lot.
Yeah, it's a great easy one to fillet. You just make a little cut on the knife. I always love that as a young fish butcher. You just make a little cut by the tail, grab the skin with one hand,
pull it off.
And with the other one with the side tail,
it may
as well come with a zipper. The easiest things in the world to fillet.
That reminds me, when I was a younger kid, when I was your son's age and less, my father used to make me skin eels. And when I was, you know, 14, 15 years old and get in trouble, he would drag me to work and make me skin a bushel of eels. And that's got to be one of the hardest things to do, you know, in the seafood industry.
Oh,
skin a bushel of live eels.
Right, they're slimy. They're not sitting still. They're gross. That's like that. There's a great fish that comes. I used to get them as a bycatch off a pot boat. It's called totog or black bass.
Oh, yeah.
Slippery
bass.
But they have this slime. When they're really fresh, they've got this almost mucousy slime on the
outside.
Like
halibut does.
Okay.
People sell that. It's like a cheap man. It's a
black bass.
Yeah,
right.
Sea bass. You
right.
know, some
right.
people try to. I heard you talking about mislabeling fish. The blackfish and the sea bass runs into that.
Totally
know,
different texture,
totally different
look.
Fish. Yeah, the closest thing is they both have black skin. You
Thank you, period. And for somehow or other, they're
But that's a Long Island fish.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I mean, those fish, you know, they have,
I love
they
tog.
Have, they have human teeth almost.
Oh, they're crazy. And when you got them, you see, they're eating little clams.
Yeah, they have got powerful
little,
jaws.
Yeah, they look like they're powerful jaws. They've got these funny lips and these teeth that stick out. Oh, man, I played a million of them in my day. All right, our hour's coming to an end. Lou Razzo has been my guest. Razzo & Sons is the company. You Google them. Fourth generation?
Fourth
generation. Still in Manhattan on 9th Avenue. I'm going to have to come by and get some Dover sole when he sees on my way home. I just swing north up 9th Avenue, hit you, because I want to bring some of those home. They're so damn good. Lou, thanks for coming on.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
All right, that was an hour's worth of fish. We're going to do this every couple of months at least. It's a topic that's near and dear to me, commercial fisheries, species management. We all should really raise the awareness and the education level of what we should eat, shouldn't eat, why, what to avoid, what to look for, what not to look for. It's been a pleasure. We'll be back next week. have a Super Bowl Sunday. Have fun this week, huh? I guess there's going to be a lot of
betting.
A lot of beer drinking, a lot of tacos, a lot of buffalo chicken wings being eaten. I don't know, man. Yeah. I think I'm rooting for Denver. I think I'm rooting for Manning just because he's an older guy and he's great. He's in a great season.
I'd like to see him win, too.
All right. On that note, have a great Super Bowl, everybody. We'll be back next week live. Take care. You have listened to another edition of Mike Colomeco's Food Talk on Heritage Radio Network. We'll be back next week with more.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.